You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the United Nations recently released a report that finds that the world's oceans are heating up and rising. We'll learn more about that report and what it's going to mean for the Earth's inhabitants if the oceans keep warming. Now, depending on your political leanings, the outcome of the 2016 presidential election was either a thrilling victory or a massive shock. Donald Trump was in many ways the dark horse candidate to both clinch the GOP nomination and then beat Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. So for Democrats, the election of Donald Trump was a big setback. For Republicans, the win was a mixed bag, which led to serious changes in the party. Our next guest has been covering the Republican Party for years and recently wrote a book about the impact President Trump has had on the GOP. Tim Alberta is chief political correspondent for Politico. He's the author of the book American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I want to start close to home, Tim, in Wisconsin. Former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker was a front runner at one point when he entered the 2016 presidential race. He ended his candidacy, and I want to give a listen to some of what he had to say at the announcement that his candidacy was ending.
I believe that I'm being called to lead by helping to clear the field in this race so that a positive conservative message can rise to the top of the field. With this in mind, I will suspend my campaign immediately. I encourage other Republican presidential candidates to consider doing the same so that the voters can focus on a limited number of candidates who can offer a positive conservative alternative to the current frontrunner. This is fundamentally important to the future of the party and, more importantly, to the future of our country.
That frontrunner at the time was Donald Trump, and now Scott Walker will be chair of Trump's reelection effort in Wisconsin. One example of something a lot of people went through, I think, Tim, before and after. Can you talk about that change in the Republican Party?
Yeah, the stages of grief, as it would relate to Donald Trump and his relationship with the Republican Party. You used the phrase before and after, which I think is a good way to think about it. If you see a weight loss commercial or a hair restoration commercial, they have those before and after pictures. And I think in a lot of ways, what you have is a before and after picture of a lot of these prominent Republicans, such as Scott Walker, Paul Ryan, Lindsey Graham, the list goes on and on. People who felt one way very clearly and very outspokenly about Donald Trump during his ascent, felt that he was an existential threat to the party, to the country. People went so far as to call him a cancer, like Rick Perry, who of course later became a member of his cabinet. And then of course you have these after pictures when all of these folks suddenly found religion on Donald Trump and realized not only that they could, you know, grin and bear it and that they could hold their nose and go along with his takeover of the party, but would begin to sing a completely different song, at least publicly, telling anybody who would listen that really he is a conservative, that really he is a positive, aspirational, forward-thinking, generational leader who we all should be rallying behind. It's just that we're all missing it. And you know, to see such a sharp 180 taken by so many of these Republican figures obviously prompts a series of questions, and at the heart of them is, you know, why are these folks all feeling compelled to fall in line behind somebody who 24 months ago nobody supported, nobody thought was a conservative, nobody called a Republican? And obviously it's a fascinating psychological case study and clearly one of the great political questions of our generation.
And you write that in many years, Donald Trump would not have been a successful Republican candidate, but he came at the right time in the midst of what you say in the title of your book was a Republican Civil War, right? Pre-Donald Trump, what was this civil war within the Republican Party?
Well, look, go back to 2008. George W. Bush is leaving office with historically high disapproval ratings. The country and really the Republican Party in large part has turned on him and soured on his performance. You have the disastrous handling of Hurricane Katrina, of the Iraq War, rising debt and deficit, Terry Schiavo, you name it. And there are these mounting crises facing the Bush administration. And then, of course, as she's preparing to leave office, who is nominated as their new Republican standard bearer? John McCain, someone who, while popular with the national media and seen as somebody who, is a maverick and kind of a political crusader, and he's won favorable headlines throughout the years. This is certainly not somebody who has ever identified with the conservative wing of the Republican Party. And John McCain, realizing that he has almost no chance to win the election in 2008 against Barack Obama, he throws a Hail Mary. He knows that he has one chance to fire up the conservative base. And who is it? It's Sarah Palin, picking her as his vice presidential running mate. And between Bush leaving office, as unpopular as he was, between McCain's pick of Sarah Palin and how he had exposed this real schism that had been brewing between sort of the elite intellectual wing of the Republican Party, the country club GOP, and the downscale blue-collar working-class Republican base. And then, of course, that fall, finally, you have the financial collapse, and you have the bank bailouts, and you have millions of Americans feeling as though Washington is rigging this system against them, that they're playing by a completely different set of rules than everyday Americans. And so this whole thing is a powder keg politically and culturally and socioeconomically inside the Republican Party, and it begins to really explode when Bush leaves office. And you have the Tea Party, you have the likes of Ted Cruz and his sort of revolutionaries coming to Washington. And we can see that all the while, there is this wave building and building and beginning to swallow up the old Republican establishment. We just didn't know ultimately who was going to ride that wave. But when Donald Trump came along and he rode down that golden escalator in Trump Tower, he was proverbially the man meeting the moment. He stepped into a political atmosphere that was absolutely perfect and ripe for his ascent.
Were there particular issues that Republicans, maybe rank-and-file Republicans, had lost faith with the establishment leaders on, and they were waiting for someone, whether it was Ted Cruz or somebody beyond him, to step into that void?
Oh, sure. I think you would start with immigration. I think that there was a real sense of disillusionment among conservatives who felt as though, you know, George W. Bush was trying to sell the party out on immigration. John McCain, his successor, obviously becoming the party's new leader in 2008 as a nominee, that he was very liberal, had been liberal for decades on the issue of immigration. Mitt Romney in 2012 sort of tried to talk tough on immigration, but this is a business guy, and this is somebody who, you know, was very much identified with the pro-immigration wing of the party. So when Donald Trump came along and started making these promises and started using this very tough and hostile and obviously nativist language about immigrants, that was something that really captured some not insignificant portion of the Republican electorate and really spoke to these pent-up feelings of frustration that had been simmering on the right for many years. Obviously, Trump also coming along and talk about exposing a schism. I talked about how Sarah Palin did that to a certain extent, and that was largely cultural, speaking to this disconnect between, you know, the elites and the everyday American. What Donald Trump really exposed was a disconnect that was both cultural but also policy-driven. I mean, Trump understood at a gut level that many Republican voters did not share the elite Republican opinion on an issue like immigration or on an issue like trade, where Donald Trump was the one person standing on that stage surrounded by free traders in the Republican primary, basically threatening to start a trade war with China and slap tariffs on incoming goods from other countries. That is something, it's hard to fully appreciate it because all of this has happened so quickly. But that's something that for the last 30 years would have gotten you thrown out of the Republican Party. It was just so alien to hear somebody on the presidential debate stage advocating that kind of position on trade. And yet what Donald Trump understood, again, is that for a lot of conservative blue-collar voters across middle America who felt that they had watched their livelihoods and their communities ravaged by these free trade agreements, they were ready for a change. They were ready to disrupt the status quo. They were no longer interested in the Wall Street Journal editorial page view on issues like trade and like immigration. And here comes Donald Trump sort of ramming at the gates of the establishment in a way that these folks had been craving for years. And I think even more than Ted Cruz, Trump was able and really prescient in identifying those sentiments and tapping into them.
Talking to Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. We're talking about his book, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a Republican, what do you think of the president? Do you think he's done good things for the GOP, for the party? Or do you put yourself with the never-Trumpers, still they're out there here in Wisconsin? What do you think Trump's long-term impact will be on the Republican Party, on American politics, wherever, whatever party you affiliate with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Hey, everybody. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. I'm a producer here on Central Time. My job is to find the people and the issues around Wisconsin that matter most to you. And honestly, the best way to do that is to ask you directly. So what stories do you want to hear on our show? What people are making a difference in your community? And what concerns do you have in the state or in your county? Tell us the questions you have that no one else is answering. You can send us an email, that's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at centraltimewpr. We want to hear your ideas and thanks.
WPR Travel presents a 13-night Earthbound Expeditions adventure in New Zealand, February 10th through 23rd. I'm Cheryl Gasser, and I'll be your host as we escape Wisconsin's winter to discover firsthand the rich culture and scenery of the South Pacific Island Nation. Early in the trip, we'll cruise Auckland's Bay, visit dramatic geysers, and learn about Maori history, music, and dance. The full itinerary can be found at wpr.org/travel.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Madison, announcing a fall food event through October 31st, including bird seed, suet, and seed cylinders. WBUMadison.com. Discover a refuge in your own backyard. Whether you laugh along with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or feed your mind with To the Best of Our Knowledge, you'll always find something to enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio. Find our program schedule and listen online at WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Tim Alberta is with us, chief political correspondent for Politico. He's with us to talk about his book, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. How do you think the Republican Party has changed over the last few years? If you have been a Republican all along, are you happy with what President Trump has done for the party, how he's changed the party, or are you worried about it? Do you think, whatever party you're part of, politics has just changed for the worse, for the better? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Before we bring on a caller, Tim, I want to bring on another Wisconsin recurring character in your book, former House Speaker Paul Ryan. He was, pro-free trade. He had to work with President Trump. He had described one of President Trump's comments as the textbook definition of racism. He had a lot of objections to President Trump, and yet he ended up working with him. You talked to Paul Ryan in the research for your book. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, yeah, and of course, Ryan is someone who was fiercely critical of Trump during his rise in 2015 and 2016, and then essentially went radio silent in criticizing Trump during their 2 years serving together. Trump as the president, Ryan as the speaker in this unified Republican government. And that was because Ryan had made the calculation, whether you agree with it or not, that he had made the calculation that, look, if I'm going to get anything done with this guy, who's extremely thin-skinned, he's very sensitive to criticism, he's insecure, and if I'm out there launching broadsides and calling him out and criticizing his behavior or his rhetoric, I'm not going to be able to get anything done with him. I need to try and exert influence on him quietly from the inside in order to both get things accomplished in government and also try and keep them from his own worst instincts. That was the calculus that Ryan made. And, of course, he pursued that strategy with varying degrees of success for about 2 years. And then when Ryan left the speakership, the first real interview that he gave afterwards was with me for the book, and he sat down and kind of let it fly and was suddenly the old Paul Ryan again, where he was not at all shy about criticizing Trump, about speaking very candidly about just how disconcerting frustrating he found the president's behavior to be, how uncomfortable he was with much of his rhetoric, and really, obviously, opened himself up to a lot of criticism himself from a lot of people who were wondering, geez, where was that the last, you know, two and a half years? And again, Ryan, a very, very mercurial figure in this book and in the story of the modern Republican Party, has sort of been on both sides of the Trump phenomenon and has elicited no shortage of hatred, and no matter which side of it he's come down on.
Let's bring on a caller now. Pat is with us in Troy. Pat, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. I recently became a registered Republican, but I was more or less an independent for the longest time. And I did vote for Trump, although I do not like Trump, and I have never liked him, and I still don't like him. I think he's arrogant. But I felt we needed a businessman and someone who could run the company and stop competing with slave labor, which is China and Mexico. And I felt Trump could do it, and I've been very pleased with what he's done. And because of that, I'll vote for him again.
Pat, thanks for the call. And Tim, I think Pat matches a lot of polls that were out there. There were a lot of people who didn't like Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, but a lot of people who didn't like Donald Trump still found ways to vote for him. And according to Pat, at least she will again.
Yeah, look, there was a huge body of research to show us in late 2016 that Donald Trump was winning the votes of a lot of people who either didn't like him or didn't think he was qualified to be president, or both. And that's a pretty phenomenal thing in American politics. You don't often see large numbers of voters telling pollsters that they're going to support a candidate who they don't like and they don't think should be in the office. And obviously much of that spoke to the discontent with Hillary Clinton as his opponent on the Democratic side. But let's be honest, I mean, I think a lot of it also just speaks to the general discontent with the political status quo that a lot of Americans are feeling, where they looked around, felt like government was broken and that they needed to, you know, send a wrecking ball into Washington, and Donald Trump was that wrecking ball. And you don't have to like the wrecking ball necessarily, but that was the mentality a lot of voters had. And at this point, despite the fact that he continues to offend and bother a lot of voters, for lack of a better way of putting it, obviously, there are still an awful lot of voters who voted for him in 2016 reluctantly, who told pollsters that they're still leaning toward voting for him again.
Thanks for that call, Pat, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Tim Alberta from Politico. His new book is American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Let's bring on another caller now. Larry is with us in Appleton. Larry, hi.
Hello.
What do you think, Larry?
Well, I think that the author gives Trump too much credit. I don't think that he's intellectually capable of having anticipated and figured this out. I think he just happened to come along when there was a level of discontent, but I think more significantly, a level of irresponsibility on the part of the American electorate. I'm 75, and I've lived through the best of times, so I don't mean to be too hard on the electorate, the younger electorate. I feel sorry for them, really. But they really have to stop being selfish and irresponsible. Voting for someone that you don't like doesn't make any sense.
Larry, thanks a lot for the call. I want to give Tim a chance to jump in. So part one of Larry's comment there, Trump is not playing, in effect, eight-dimensional chess or whatever people are saying. He just hit the right place at the right time, Tim.
Well, look, I think there are two oversimplifications of Trump. One is that he's playing eight-dimensional chess and he's always 10 moves ahead of everybody, and that there's just a strategic mastermind there that you can't see. And the other is that he's this fumbling idiot who just kind of wanders his way into success unwittingly. I think neither one is really true. Look, at the end of the day, you don't have to have some grand intellectual capacity or have read political science books to have a read on the electorate. I think what makes Trump so interesting is that despite living in, you know, a gilded penthouse on Fifth Avenue, this is somebody who for the last 20 years, even before running for president, you go back and read interviews with him that go back to the late 1980s, this is somebody who talked about the fact that the two major parties and the elites in the two major parties were selling out a lot of blue-collar working Americans on those issues of immigration and trade. If there's one thing Trump has been insistent on, it is speaking to those specific issues. So I don't necessarily agree that Trump just sort of lucked into this in 2016, but I do understand where Larry's coming from, which is to push back on this notion that Trump was somehow the man behind the curtain orchestrating all of this in a way that none of us simpletons could have understood. I also agree with him that the American electorate has become lazy and tribalized and polarized to a degree that is really harmful to this country's future, not even as it pertains to Trump specifically, but even as it pertains to Congress. When you look at the makeup of the federal government and who we send to Washington, that is a direct reflection on an electorate that has not been doing its job well.
All right, I want to spend at least our last few minutes, Tim, on what's going on now, what could be a post-epilogue to your book. As you wrapped up your book, there's like some talk like impeachment. No, that's too out there for the Democrats at that point. Well, now here we are. What do you make of all this?
Well, shoot. I mean, the president just keeps handing ammunition to the Democratic Party, practically begging them to come after him. And you know, there are quite a few Republicans close to the president who have told him and whispered in his ear more than once that impeachment is the best possible thing that could happen to him as far as mobilizing his base in 2020. That's not to say that the president is necessarily leaking these things himself or, again, that this is eight-dimensional chess, but the president is in a position now where a Republican base that has been somewhat fractured in its support of him. And you can look at public opinion polls to see that 9 out of 10 Republicans support him. But that doesn't account for lots of people who have been Republican for 50 years who are now identifying as independent. The party itself is contracting under Trump. There's no question about that. The question really is, to what degree did Democrats not just galvanize and mobilize their own base with impeachment, but also galvanize and mobilize the Republican base to circle the wagons around Trump in a way that they might otherwise have not up until this point? I think that's sort of the danger for Democrats, but clearly they have crossed the Rubicon and feel as though there's no turning back.
And is there turning back for the Republican Party post-Donald Trump, whenever that is in his political career? Do things go back to the old ways for Republicans?
Oh, I doubt it. I don't think things go back to the old ways for either party. I think we are thoroughly through the looking glass as Americans at this point. When you think about the fact that 4 freshman Democratic congresswomen have more power than the Speaker of the House of Representatives, that is not a reflection of Donald Trump. It is a reflection of the current political ecosystem fueled by outside money and activism and social media. The playing field is so flat and so democratized at this point that the political establishment of both parties are basically neutered, and they just do not have the power, the authority to wield like they used to. And I think that that makes it a whole new ballgame, and it opens us up to an entirely different sort of government moving forward, a government that is far less traditional and far less orthodox in its conventions and in its institutions than it once was.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
It's Tim Alberta, chief political correspondent for Politico. He's the author of American Carnage, On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Coming up, the latest United Nations report on the state of the world's oceans is bleak. They're heating up and getting higher, and that's going to be a big problem for people. 2 Wisconsin experts join the show for a look at the latest report. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to the head of Wisconsin's State Patrol about their latest efforts on enforcement and how they recruit new officers. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a major report from the United Nations paints a stark picture. The oceans are warming, sea levels are rising, and the consequences of those changes could be severe for life across the globe. In Wisconsin, we don't live on the ocean, but we may see and feel the impact of these warming oceans through more severe weather and potential changes to our freshwater systems in the state. Our next guests join us to talk about the report and how it could affect us here in Wisconsin. Paul Rober is a distinguished professor in the College of Letters and Science, where he studies weather forecasting and is the director of innovative weather. He's at UW-Milwaukee. Paul, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Sandra McClellan is a professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. Sandra, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks.
Paul, starting with you, you work a lot on weather forecasting. How does a warming ocean or the warming oceans of the world affect our weather?
Well, so they're actually, it seems like people in the Midwest might not think that this is particularly important to their immediate concerns. But it turns out that ocean temperatures play a really big role in sort of the global wind patterns that affect weather both sort of regionally and locally. And one good example of that is these longer-term persistent kind of weather regimes that we've seen over the past several years, especially during the winter. We don't know for sure that this is the cause, but we do know that the oceans tend to force the atmosphere into particular kinds of wind patterns. And so it seems pretty likely that a lot of that persistent, you know, if you're thinking back to some of those colder, gloomier periods that we had for week after week, a lot of that may be tied to these warming ocean temperatures. So that's one really important influence. And the second one actually is much more localized, relates to Great Lakes water levels through a fairly complicated process that I can get to if you want to hear more about that.
Yeah, I want to check in with Sandra before we dig into that. Paul, Sandra, you study freshwater symptoms. Just from your seat here in Wisconsin, what did you think of this UN report?
Well, you know, it's an eye-opener, I think, for a lot of people, but it's something that I've been watching probably for the last 10 years. I've been working with some of the climatologists in Madison at UW-Madison and then also here in Milwaukee on the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. And 10 years ago, there were a few things on our radar screen for Wisconsin, and I've noticed in this report that the same things we were watching 10 years ago are becoming more certain. And the one piece of it that I'm really kind of tuned into is the possibility of more frequent, intense storms. So I think a lot of people hear, you know, climate change and global warming, oh, it's getting warmer. But when we start looking at water quality, one of the biggest consequences for quality is not necessarily the temperature, it's the links to exactly what Dr. Robosch said, changing these weather patterns, and suddenly we're seeing these more severe storms more frequently. And there's just very large impacts on water quality when you're in an urban area when we have intense storms, like the 2 and 3 inches we saw about a week or two ago.
And Paul, you mentioned the formula kind of for how the warming oceans can change our weather patterns. Spell that out for us a little bit.
So basically what happens, for example, there's been what's been called a warm blob in the Pacific Ocean. And so that heat that's stored in the ocean actually affects the overlying air and throws up what we call in meteorology a ridge, which is just an area where the winds are going more from the north towards the southeast. And so there's this ridge pattern over the west that is reflected based on that ocean temperatures. And then we in the Midwest and the east get stuck in this trough pattern. And the trough pattern is the opposite to the ridge. It's an area where the winds are starting to turn around. And those are areas where we have more storm systems, both more well-organized storms like winter cyclones, but also what Sandra was talking about, the severe storms that develop in those kinds of patterns.
And Paul, you mentioned those heat blobs in the ocean. And as I understand this, this is something that wasn't really on our radar, the idea that we might have these, in effect, heat waves building up and staying long-term in the oceans. Is this a fairly recent finding?
Well, there are a number of things that are just becoming more prominent. So I wouldn't say that was not recognized, say, 10 or 20 years ago. But one of the most salient points about climate change is that all the estimates that have been summarized, for example, in the IPCC reports, have been underestimates of the changes that have actually occurred. So in other words, they've all been too conservative. And this is one example of that. Another is what you alluded to at the beginning, sea level rise, where initially all the IPCC reports were really talking about one of the two components of sea level rise, which is the warming of the oceans themselves, which causes the volume to expand. So you get a little bit of rise associated with that. But another big contributor, which is now the majority of the contribution to sea level rise, is global ice melt. So that's melting ice in the glaciers around the world, but also ice melt in the Greenland ice pack and the Antarctic ice shelf in particular.
Sandra, there are concerns here in the Midwest about the Great Lakes. So there was just a hearing in Ashland where people were raising concerns about algae blooms in Lake Superior, the impacts of runoff from some of those big storm events like the ones you were just talking about. How do we start to measure what's going on, and not in the oceans in this case, but in the Great Lakes when it comes to the impact of climate change?
You know, that's a really good question, because it's hard to separate the impact we're having just from our cities and everyday anthropogenic activities like, you know, farming and street runoff. So that's already degrading water quality, causing these harmful algal blooms, causing beach closings, causing sewage overflows. So as we're trying to fix these things, what's happening is they're getting worse because we're having more storms. So we're taking problems that are already there and making them worse, which means the measures we are trying to do to make them better, we have to start ramping up some of those efforts. So I think as we raise awareness of kind of climate change, we have to remember that these problems are already, you know, problems that already exist that we need to be addressing. It's just a warning that, oh, we might need to do more now because of the climate change than we had planned to do maybe 10 years ago.
Talking to Paul Rober and Sandra McClellan. They're with us from the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. We're talking about a recent UN report on how the oceans are changing in the era of climate change, and they're getting warmer, for one thing, and higher, and how that could impact the wet weather and freshwater, even here in the Midwest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the state of the oceans and what it means for us in Wisconsin? What do you want to know about this report? What would you like to see change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or, as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the recent United Nations report that finds the oceans are getting hotter, the sea levels are rising. We're talking about that report and how warming oceans will impact the climate, the world, and even us here in Wisconsin. Our guests are both professors at UW-Milwaukee, Sandra McClellan and Paul Rober. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the report? What steps do you think governments should take in order to slow the warming of the planet and the oceans? Do you have questions for our guest about climate change in general? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sandra, the report talks about threats to biodiversity from warming oceans and acidification. Do we have similar worries in our freshwater here in the Midwest of the species that live in our waterways?
You know, I can't answer that question specifically, because I think the answer is going to be we don't know. The Great Lakes are, you know, sensitive to warming, but we don't have some of the longer term records that the oceans have, and some of the monitoring and some of the data that's been collected. But speaking just from a more general biology perspective, there are always going to be underlying effects. These organisms have adapted to their environment over thousands of years. So if we change it drastically in a 10 or 20 year period by, you know, a couple of degrees temperature, or perhaps in certain lakes, more runoff, more nutrients, that's actually, while it seems like a slow time scale for us, that's actually a big time scale for organisms that, you know, have adapted for a very long period of time. So, you know, the short answer is yes, we expect some changes. And the longer answer is we really need to figure out what those changes might be.
I'm going to bring on a caller now. Zach is with us in Milwaukee. Zach, hi.
Hey, you guys. I had a question. I'm curious about the potential for polar vortexes to occur during the summer. So if there's like that same potential for that disruption of that air mass over the Arctic, but to like almost bring freezing temperatures, say in like July, is that possible, or is that more of a winter-related thing.
Zach, thanks for the call. Kind of a day after tomorrow, I think, was the movie. Paul, I think that's in, more in your neighborhood. Air masses over the Arctic maybe getting more mobile even in the summer, Zach's worried about.
Yeah, sure. So the first thing to know about the polar vortex is that you can look at any weather map at any time of the year. In fact, just for fun, I looked at the hottest day in Milwaukee on record and found the polar vortex on that day. So it's always there. What you're really talking about is these excursions of the high Arctic air to lower latitudes, and that's primarily a winter phenomenon. So you can get coolish air that might come in during the summer, but you're never going to get a real cold air outbreak in the summer. And in fact, the warming that has been occurring has occurred most prominently in the high latitudes. So up in the polar regions, they're actually warming a lot faster than we are due to climate change.
Zach, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on Guy from West Allis now. Guy, hi.
Hello. Talking to a lot of people who are skeptical about climate change, it seems as though they always say it's a natural occurring thing. And I agree with that to a point, but it's not natural that it's occurring over 150 to 200 years, where normally it would be thousands and thousands of years. It's like throwing a pebble into a puddle with a little ripple, either that or throwing a big boulder in there. The ripple effect is much more amplified.
Guy, thanks for the call. And Sandra, you were talking about the pace of change maybe being too fast for example, species to deal with. Do you have that worry that Guy does, that this is faster than, you know, kind of the normal historical climate change the Earth experiences?
Yeah, I think we can all look at the charts and the data that has been collected, even just on the CO2, and we can see the sharp increase in a very short period of time. One thing that I've noticed over the last 10 years, looking at what all the scientists in the community have written across, you know, many different countries on the IPCC, you know, even just 4 and 6 years ago, they used terms like very likely and likely and moderate confidence. But in this report, I'm starting to see words like virtually certain and much more confidence in the results. And I think, and Paul alluded to that earlier, you know, in 2015, 10 years ago, people were kind of conservative of what they said about climate change, and there were skeptics back then. Well, now we have 10 more years of science, much more attention to it, and I think we're getting a better picture of what's really going on. And that's what was so eye-opening for me just going through this report is, you know, we're much more certain now of what's being projected 50 years out.
Thanks a lot for that call. Paul, earlier Sandra talked about those high-intensity rainstorms. It's hard to think of a part of the state that hasn't been hit with them in the last couple of years. We've got flood warnings for south-central Wisconsin now. With the trends going on out there in the oceans and the peaks and troughs you were talking about earlier, is there a chance this could be the new normal, these heavy rainstorms that exceed our infrastructure that was built for less floody times?
Yeah, I'd say not only is there a chance of it, it's a virtual guarantee of it. And the reason I say that is because as the temperatures warm, what happens is there's a lot more available moisture in the atmosphere, and all you need is the right other ingredients to form, which they will on certain days, to really start wringing out that moisture. And so you just have the capacity for what was more ordinary storm a few years ago to really produce a lot more precipitation from it.
And Sandra, in our last few moments, you said there are still a lot of question marks about how climate change is going to affect the Great Lakes and our freshwater in the Midwest. What is the next bit of evidence, the next bit of data that you're watching for?
You know, I think that we know it's going to happen. We already know what a severe storm does to a community, either with runoff or with flooding. So I think looking forward, we know what the predictions are. We need to start looking at how we manage that runoff and how we build our cities. And I think, you know, we've looked at maybe 2 inches of rainfall, you know, happening once or twice a year. Well, what if that happens 5 times a year? How is our infrastructure going to contain that? So going forward, I think it's going to be more in the planning and proactive things we can do that's going to help us kind of protect those species and protect water quality, because I think all of it is pretty vulnerable.
Sandra, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Paul, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
We've been talking to Sandra McClellan, professor in the School of Freshwater Sciences at UW-Milwaukee, and Paul Rober, distinguished professor in the College of Letters and Science at UW-Milwaukee, where he studies weather forecasting. He's the director of innovative weather there. They join us to talk about a United Nations report on oceans. The report found that the oceans are rising and getting warmer, which could have profound consequences for people, and as we've been hearing, can affect us even here in the Midwest. Last year, 8 small Iowa hospitals stopped delivering babies. That cutback is a response to the financial challenges felt by many hospitals across the Midwest. But as Iowa Public Radio's Natalie Krebs reports in the second part of a 5-part series, these closures can be hard for expectant mothers and their rural communities.
At the Coffee Attic Cafe off the main street in Iowa Falls, Jessica Sheridan plays with her 8-month-old daughter, Aria.
I'm going to be noisy.
Aria is Sheridan's first child, born last December. Sheridan says she initially planned to give birth at Hanson Family Hospital, just 5 minutes from her house. But when she was 7 months pregnant, that suddenly changed.
I think October is actually when we learned that the labor and delivery unit was talking about closing. And obviously we were like kind of in a panic.
Sheridan says she was worried because this meant she would have to drive at least 45 minutes to deliver. As her December due date neared, Sheridan circulated a petition.
I think there were like over 800 signatures or something like that.
She says she brought it to hospital officials, but they closed the unit in November. Aria was born in a city an hour away. Doug Morse is the CEO of Hanson Family Hospital. He says leaders ultimately decided that the labor and delivery unit was too expensive in the aging rural community where births are on the decline.
One of the hardest lessons that we learned as a community was to deliver those 86 babies, this hospital was losing nearly $1 million.
Hanson Family is hardly the only hospital making this tough choice. In recent years, many hospitals across Iowa and the U.S. have shuttered their labor and delivery units. Stephen Hunter is the vice chair of obstetrics at the University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics. He says studies have shown this can create problems.
There's a higher rate of preterm delivery. There's a higher rate of out-of-hospital deliveries. There's a lower access to prenatal care.
Hanson Family CEO Morse says this is one of the reasons the hospital adopted a share care program. This means women can still get all their pre- and postnatal care in Iowa Falls. But they have to travel an hour north to Mason City to deliver.
The idea is you do as much as you can in a rural community and then work with a referral center to partner and then come back to the rural community.
Molly Forgey of nearby Ackley says the program worked for her. She had her son in Mason City last April.
I did not feel that I missed out on anything through having to go to 2 facilities and seeing 2 providers.
But traveling an hour to deliver is more difficult for others. Local resident Nicole Grover is 8 months pregnant, and she doesn't have a car to get to Mason City.
It's a little scary not knowing like if I'm going to have time to get there or if something happens, I'm going to have to go by an ambulance.
2 hours southeast of Iowa Falls, another hospital in a small aging community is bucking the trend.
The bathrooms, which we tried to do upscale so they don't feel like they're in a facility, but we've got a whirlpool bath.
At Compass Memorial Hospital in the eastern town of Marengo, population 2,400, CEO Barry Getch walks through the hospital's new upscale labor and delivery unit. Construction workers are still putting the final touches on it.
Yeah, see, they're still kind of working on that.
Getch says local women currently have to drive to big cities to give birth. He wants to keep them here.
People who live in our area deserve the best, and they shouldn't have to drive 45 minutes or further to get the perceived best from somebody bigger.
Getch says the small hospital is projecting to lose about $1 million to deliver around 150 babies a year. Still, he says opening the unit is just the right thing to do.
That's the nature of healthcare. I mean, if we're not doing what's right and we're not doing the best we can for the folks that utilize our organization, then we kind of miss the point of being in healthcare.
Gutch says Compass Memorial hopes to open the unit by the end of next year. I'm Natalie Krebs, Iowa Public Radio News.
Tomorrow, our series continues with a look at a Minnesota municipal hospital that has endured despite losing money for more than a decade. These reports are part of a collaboration of 12 newsrooms, including Wisconsin Public Radio, and led by Iowa Watch and the Institute for Nonprofit News, with additional support from the Solutions Journalism Network. For more information, visit hospitals.iowawatch.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll get the latest on subpoenas in the congressional inquiry into President Trump and his administration as part of our weekly roundup of the latest news in national politics. We'll get a sneak preview of the newest season of Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public Television, and one of Wisconsin's newest conservation workers is helping sniff out invasive species. We'll get the story of Telia, the conservation dog, who's welcoming visitors and helping spot unwelcome plants in a Wisconsin nature preserve. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 7:15, Set the Controls for the Heart of the Sun. Kate talks to a UW researcher who's creating an artificial sun simulator to help dig into the secrets of the universe. That's tomorrow at 7:15 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a personal finance writer who says the money advice a lot of us got from our parents may be wrong for the current generation. You can get an early start on the conversation. Share your thoughts on student loan debt and whether you think you'll ever be able to buy a house. Join in on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.